Okay, the first lady begin by saying Shura Sabi Mori. Special privilege for me to be able to to present something in conjunction with my father. That in itself would obviously be a very nice thing, but in addition to being my father, is also my rabbi. And all my experience, actually, in synagogue life, which is what I'm speaking about, more, as I've never been the rabbi of the synagogue. I've always been either the son or one of the balabatim. But I've always, had this chus to observe the way my father conducts himself. And the truth is, whatever approaches I have to these matters and to many others, really have their roots in that, being able to observe him, in that way, both as a son and as a congregant. I think I've been maybe a better congregant even than
no, it's good as son as a congregant.
Okay, thank you. So it really is a special schus, and we thank Ezra Schwartz, who had the idea. At the same time, that poses a bit of a problem, logistically and structurally and time-wise. The topic is a very important one, and it's a big one. It would be difficult to exhaust or to do justice to, even if we weren't splitting up the presentations. The fact that we're splitting them up obviously makes it now more difficult. So what I'd like to do is, I'm going to begin with a kind of presentation, a survey of some of the issues and some of the categories, make a few comments about some of the directions, provide a framework, and then Avi Mori will speak about some of the practical issues and some advice and some experience, how some of these things play out. And then after that, either we'll take questions, or if there's more time, then I'd like to go into some details of some of the issues as well. And if not, then Od Chazon LaMoed. And either way, well, thank you for, I didn't get a chance to look at it yet, but I guess most of the marble comments that I gave are here. There are many more, obviously. I tried to just give a sampling of some of the perspectives. Okay. The topic that we're presented with, which is the role of the non-observant Jew in the synagogue according to the halacha, aspects of this topic are indigenous to halachic life and community life and apply to all eras and all geographic locations as well. Every Jewish community has had avaryanim. Hopefully they didn't overrun the communities, but there were always obviously people who were not able to fulfill the highest and most ideal standards of halacha, and how to deal with them in the context of what is a pillar, a mainstay in the community, namely the Beit HaKnesset, is something that obviously would always have to come up. But there are other elements of the topic, as we treat it today, that are a product of the anomalies of, I would say, modern Jewish history. The phenomenon of, number one, rampant non-observance. Well, the majority of the Jewish community is actually non-observant, not even just non-observant, but ignorant, and where the non-observance is of a certain scope. In other words, when you had traditional Jewish communities, so you had avaryanim, but it was almost inconceivable that you would have a mechalal Shabbos b'farhesya or a large group of them, constantly involved in the Beis HaKnesset. They would have been ostracized from the community, never mind the Beis HaKnesset, because the community was run according to halacha. And it just would be inconceivable. So you had Averos, Chayve Lavin, other things, but the idea of an Apikoros or a Kofar, however that's defined, or Bekal Shabbos Befarhesia, who is a Mumer L'Chol HaTorah Kula, or a Mumer L'Hachis, the idea that you would have some question how to treat him in the Beis HaKnesses, would have been very peculiar. Mostly, it would have been run out of the community. There were means, how to deal with him, and so on. So in one respect, aspects of the problem as we deal with it today, some of the more thorny aspects, are really a product of the anomalies of modern Jewish life. The fact is that in our Batei Knesset, Knesiot, we encounter many people who, not only are in the category of Avaryanim, but who have very little, little connection with halachic life. Generally, this can be so. And it's particularly true certain times in the year. Obviously, Yahrzeit, with all of the psychological and emotional impact that has on people, brings people to shul, You know, they don't come on their own, but they come for their father, for their grandfather, whoever it is. The context of Yahrzeit itself, on the one hand, creates for greater opportunities of kiruv, but also risk of richuk. People are very emotional when it comes to their Yahrzeit. You treat them nicely, they may come back. You treat them dismissively, and they're particularly insulted. They didn't just have a bad experience the one time a year that they come to shul, but also the time when they were most vulnerable and when they take the greatest umbrage, I guess, for having been treated that way. The Yom Noraim represents another case in point, and since we are on the edge of the Yom Noraim, so it's particularly important. The Yom Noraim presents a similar dialectical, in this case, a dialectical challenge. Again, more people come to shul on Yom Noraim than come all year round. It used to be even more so. I remember the earlier days. You know, there were the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur Jews who really populated the shul, who never showed up the rest of the year. You have more people who show up the rest of the year in shuls now because things have improved, and you have less people who only show up on Yom Noraim because that whole concept of people who were kind of attached to Yadus and even to Orthodox shuls who didn't come, you know, the rest of the year. Unfortunately, in that respect of it, there's less of it. The people who are unaffiliated and unconnected or disconnected are more disconnected. They don't even bother coming to Yom Noraim services, or they go to places which don't have any kind of standard. But on the one hand, the Yom Kippurim and Yom Noraim is characterized by greater and higher standards. The question of Tumah V'Tahara and Pasakum, that's discussed in Shulchan Aruch on an individual level. But even on the level of standards in the Beit HaKnesset, right, the Shliach Tzibur standards are a higher level on Yom Noraim. You should be a Merutza L'Kahal, you should be Nasui, and so on and so forth. Things that we're not makbid about necessarily all year round, but we have higher standards for the Yom Noraim. The stakes are greater. The Shliach Tzibur has to be of a higher caliber as well. At the same time, there's this greater opportunity to encourage and to draw in those who frequent only at these times, only who come to Kol Nidre. B'yeshiva shalmala, b'yeshiva shalmata, right? Anu matirim lispala lima avaryanim is how we begin Kol Nidre, pretty much. Based as it is on the Gemara in Krisus about the chelbana, which is one of the ingredients of the Ktores, and the Gemara in Tainis, about, you know, there being no such thing as a Tainish, which doesn't include the tefillas of Avaryanim. So we were happy that there are Avaryanim in the Beis HaKnesset on Yom Kippurim. So on the one hand, we have this challenge to raise standards for everybody's sake. And at the same time, how do we navigate the opportunities and our desire to implement those opportunities at the same time? One of the tshuvas that I think I gave you, yeah, it is one, in Chelek Gimel, Simen Yud Beis, in the Igros Moshe, Or Chaim, so he specifically struggles with this issue, and I think I found it here before, just a second, let's see if I can find the line. It's just interesting the way that he deals with it. What page would that be? 21. Okay, yeah. Shutigros Moshe Chelek Yorachayim. I won't quote much because I don't have much time, but I just think it's very pointed the way he says it. Chelek Yorachayim Gimel Simen Yud Beis, towards the end of the piece. You'll see almost halfway, a little more than halfway down. Ubiyomim Naraim, Yesh Tam Lakan Lakan. He's talking about whether one should make a Lemachme when it comes to standards. He says, when it comes to Yom Naraim, exactly this issue, there are reasons to go on either direction. People are particularly receptive. People who are there, even if they're otherwise avaryanim, are obviously people who believe in the Rabbanu Shalom and have some connection to halacha. The gam yesh laharbe mehem mimela hiru tshuva sheyose yesh lekarim letorah mibishari masa shetam giving aliyos. To give them an aliyah is easier because they're more likely to be in a frame of mind where it's meaningful for them and therefore it's plausible for us. At the same time, b'yesh tam lehefech, shabim yom emelo atzorech yose lizoyer, v'af bedvarim shein b'chiyovim lizoyer kol hashana, k'disei quotes the issue of pasakum, k'mochenu b'chol davar. But then it's interesting how he concludes, yoser nota shu rak bedvarim shein nogei la'acherim, aval dvarim shachumru hu kula lezulzu b'chvod acherim, sh'efshu she'esham hiru tshuva, l'shayich l'hachmir, sh'lchein yesh l'hakel. When it comes to your personal chumras, that's clear. But for you to be machmir so that other people will feel less comfortable, the Beis HaKnesses, and there'll be zilzul kavodam, aval kofrim mamish b'chol ofen ein likrov haTorah. Yet there are still standards which we'll speak about. V'lerov b'nei adam nehastam shaboyim lispalel mutar. You don't have to make an FBI investigation. You can assume most people that they are sincere, even if their deeds and their general observance doesn't match that level. But there one should be more makel on Yom Kippurim than general. But I think it highlights very nicely the problem and the issue. Generally, these issues are encountered Kol HaShana as well, obviously. The potential for Avaryanim to have a meaningful experience in the Beis HaKnesses, which is going to transform who they are, what they are. The Rambam's comment regarding Tzias Kapayim, which is spoken of in a number of these tshuvas as well, which is that if a person is an Avaryan, he's a Kohen, we dafka want him to be Nosei Kapayim, because why should we add to his Averos? On the contrary, let him do this one mitzvah, maybe it'll be a good start and a foundation for other things. That's something that always has to be balanced as against the notion of standards. The status of Beis HaKnesses, on the one hand, is Mikdash Ma'at, but also in our era, as the single most important framework for Jewish thought and for religious identification, is again part of this discussion. In the Tshuvas V'Hanhagos of Rav Sternbach, he discusses the problem. What if you can, you know, should you, if there's a minyan of people who include Avaryanim, let's say, and they need you to make the minyan, but you're uncomfortable davening in that minyan, you'd rather be davening with the elite, Shlomei Munei Yisrael, a few blocks away. But if you don't come, there won't be this minyan. So he says very clearly that in his opinion, even if it means davening b'yichidus, if you really can't reconcile the standards of that shul, as long as it's in an Orthodox shul, we're not talking about deviations groups, that it's better for you to daven b'yichidus or to daven with people that you're more uncomfortable with, but to make sure that they have the minyan, than sometimes to daven in a better environment. And the reason is, he says, because the existence of a minyan, a viable minyan in the Beis HaKnesses, transcends the mitzvos of tefillah. He's speaking about the reality of Johannesburg. He says, without the shul, there is no community life, and there is no halachic presence in the Orthodox community. It's questionable whether there's going to be any identification with Jewish life, and if there is, it's not going to be with halachic life. And therefore, sometimes concessions that would otherwise be unthinkable if you were to analyze them in a more narrow way become necessary. They drive the situation. Rav Herzog has an interesting tshuva as well, which I think we have here, one of the tshuvas, where he's very makil in many things, being mitzarif, all sorts of problematic people. Again, I hope to get the details later, to minyanim and giving aliyos and other such things. But at the end of the tshuva, he says, of course, he's talking about a person who bequeathed the Beis HaKnesses or money to the Beis HaKnesses under certain conditions. So in the end, he says, of course, if you can daven in a better environment where the people are much more committed, then that would be much better. It's interesting. Rav Herzog is actually more makil in some of the standard issues than Rav Sternbach is, and yet, because of the particular circumstances that he either experienced or is discussing, he is also more inclined to tell people that, if you can get a better minyan, go there. And Rav Sternbach, who's speaking about Johannesburg, is in general more machmir in some of the standard issues, doesn't see as much room for flexibility, and yet, where there is room for flexibility, he would prefer to maintain the local minyan, even at the expense of a better davening, because in Chutz La'aretz, in places like this, he sees this of transcendent value. Yeah.
So first, where Shulach speak about this on a mishpacha level, let's say there's the parents want them for Yom HaNarayim.
No, not in these tshuvas anyway that I'm aware of. It's a very good question, and maybe if we have time later on, we'll discuss it fully or afterwards. But I think it's a very relevant question. You can see that that a lot of the issues here are complex, and therefore your assessment of the situation. Of course, you have to, let me say at the outset, you have to determine what where there is flexibility and where there is not, and flexibility in two senses. This is true in all psak, but it's of course true in this case as well. Number one, what is aser and what is mutter? Clear cut. There might be things that are mutter that are not ideal, but they're mutter. There might be things that are asur, and they're clear-cut asur, even though the consequences are going to be very unhappy for furthering the larger agenda of halakhic life. But they're asur. There's nothing you can do. The question is, when you have the flexibility, but it's not ideal, or when you have a difference of opinion among legitimate poskim, and the question is, that gives you certain flexibility to rely in certain cases, what are you going to do then? And then the question is, to weigh all sorts of factors, to weigh the issue of standards and the value that you gain from that on the one hand, with the price that you're paying for not being sufficiently inclusive, which is another religious value. And things like this time of the year, that time of the year, for this member of the family, for the whole family, those are going to be factors that are going to be factored in to that larger equation. You're not always going to get a scientific formula from these tshuvas or from the makoros to solve every problem, but at least you will develop an instinct. You'll get parameters, what's plausible, what's possible, and so on, and you'll also begin to develop an instinct of how they resolve these kind of problems, which is the value of all of this. The reality, therefore, is crucial here, determining the stakes. There's no infinite flexibility. There are things that are clearly usur and clearly problematic. There are things that are clearly mutter, even if they're not desirable. But assessing what is at stake becomes very, very important in this context. Again, in the same body of work, the Teshuvah Svanagos of Rav Sternbuch, so he has a remarkable tshuva, a sad tshuva, in which, I don't know if it's here or not, in which he discusses, I think it is here. Yeah. Nishalti mekihila nidachas kan, again, Johannesburg, this is page, do they have page numbers?
Yeah, on top.
33? The second to last page. Like an amazing thing, just to show you the reality. We live in New York. We don't live in Yerushalayim. The people living in Yerushalayim had a different sense of reality and experience, too. We live in New York. We encounter certain diversity in America. But, when you live in Johannesburg, it's New York looks like, Borough Park or Bnei Brak. So listen to this. Nishalti mekila nidachas, correctly so, kan, shashtech tzibur shalem li yom kippurim chala. The regular chazan got sick. Umatzu shatz kohen shomer Shabbos. That was just the right. The gorach manazvon, okay. Im nachris, mifnei shalom giruha, sh'asa begiorah. So you have this fellow who's a kohen, he's shomer Shabbos, but he's living with a non-Jew. V'hu bal tzvila na'a, he knows the nusach, he has a good voice. Midach yisa matzu tachlif rak yehudi shano pirish, mechala Shabbos v'farhesya. V'nishalti ma'adif, so he has to choose, which should be the shliach tzipor for Yom Kippur. The one, the shomer Shabbos ki hilchasa with every chumra of Rav Moshe Feinstein who's living with a non-Jew. Or the other fellow, who I guess at least his Jewish identity is stronger in a way, but his Chilul Shabbos is Befarhesya. Rav Echad Kan Pasak Likach Abol Nachris Lo Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya Shu Ka'akum, because technically on the books the Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya is an Akum, and Abol Aramis is a Kanoim Pogimbo, but it doesn't say that he's a Ka'akum. And Rav Sternbuch thinks the opposite. V'nir Adav Shem Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya Nafka Dino Ka'akum Below Begarim Akum. Hello, ain't the chachil Hashem gedola milikach shatz goras kumanas lan b'farhesia manachris? Bezegufa yavel nisuve taroves, meaning you have to take the bigger picture here. Then in the end he says, okay, nereisi mutav levata legamri aminyan. These are your choices. V'lo yischal Hashem shemayim b'farhesia likach shatz shigarim nachris. Kashein acher al king yikach hamachal shabbos rachmanu letzlan. Bezel kapanim kosher osam liyadu shalei tamu legamri begoyim. Then he ends, oy lanu kichatanu adshem magia lanu ayom. She'elas ka'elos. So it's, you don't need to say more than that. I mean, this is the reality in Europe and South Africa and places that make America look like it's a religious paradise. But you have to deal with those realities. Sometimes you can say, it's just unacceptable no matter what. And sometimes, for the greater good, if there is flexibility, you have to figure out how to operate. But we need to assess what is at stake, and I think... my father will speak soon about that as well. You have to know what kind of community you live in and what messages are being sent and what is possible within that community within the flexible lines. We need to be animated by the stirring words of the Rambam in Igeret Teiman regarding the need for flexibility. Rambam here, not a Gerot Tamar, a Gerot Hashmad, I'm sorry. V'chein ein ra'oi l'harchik mechal le'shabbos v'limos osam. Even if it's mechal le'shabbos, we have to try to be mekarev them. El l'karvam l'zarzam l'asiyas ha'mitzvos. V'kvar pirshir ha'boseinu zal sh'ha'poshei y'mpasher b'rtzona k'shiyavu l'beis ha'knesses l'izpalel. Even if he's a poshei ha'b'nezid, he's a moreid. Nonetheless, when he comes to shul, mekablen osam v'ein no'agin bo minag b'zayom. V'samchal zem b'divrei shlomo sh'omar lo yavuzu l'ganav. Ki ignov l'malenav show ki yirav avozu l'pishe Yisrael shein boim b'seiser lignov mitzvos. So basically, again, this is the Rambam's caution that you have to, as much as is possible within the boundaries of halacha, you want to encourage people, you want to be makar of them, and so on. At the same time, we need to protect the singular status of the Beis HaKnesses as a place in which Davar Sheba Kedusha takes place, and as a place which itself is a Davar Sheba Kedusha, even when we're not engaged in Dvarim Sheba Kedusha. The fact is that, Nihuv Beis HaKnesses, which is also a big subject in Halacha, reflects that idea that the place is a place of Lifnei Hashem, and certainly as Dvarim Sheba Kedusha take place there, the Avodah Shebalev takes place there, the avoda for which Hasidim Arishonim were Shoa Sha'achas Lifnei Atvila, shouldn't be a simple matter for us, even for the sake of Kiruv, simply to dilute the standards of such a place and such a framework and such a context. In other words, we're being pulled very strongly in both directions at the same time. Even the status of Beis HaKnesses as a Mikdash Ma'ad itself is one which is complex, implying high standards, patterned just one more second, after the Beis HaMikdash itself, where a Zar could not enter and could not be Karev, a Tamei was excluded, but at the same time, where you required Tvila to enter, but at the same time, a place which was viewed as a national headquarters for Klal Yisrael, and in which, of course, the primary function was to provide an outlet for Avaryanim to square their past. This too is the two elements that we deal with in the Mikdash Ma'ad of the Beis HaKnesset. Yeah.
So I was wondering if the far behind saying that we have to uphold our standards is because of the fact that we can't be pulled down to a certain compromise at a certain point. Because that would be as if we're not really makariving the person.
I think so. I think there are many factors involved. Number one, there is the standards themselves, and the value that they have as a Bodas Hashem that we don't want to compromise, but we have to weigh therefore against other things. Secondly, which I think is the point that you just made, which is, to put it succinctly, and you'll tell me if this isn't what you meant, sometimes it undermines kiruv when you undercut standards. You may be motivated that way, and I think this is a broader issue, but what you really project in the process is that you're not really serious about your values. And that's never been makar of anyone. You have to find a balance of showing people we really care about our standards. There are limits beyond which we will not go. We are being flexible only to expose you and to encourage you ultimately to adopt those very standards. Moreover, there's always the relationship between the people who you're trying to be makari, for whom, let's say, it would be good kiruv, let's say not your scenario, but also what message is being projected to the rest of the community about ideal standards and the ability to compromise. And here again, the tzibyon, the makeup of a community and knowing who your clientele is, I think is a very, very crucial issue again, which the real Rav Rosenzweig will be speaking about, I guess, among other things. So the factors of, if you look at the makoros themselves, all these tshuvas, no matter who writes them, again, the perspectives are different, the circumstances are different, and in some cases the views of what flexibility exists or how much weight to give factors are quite different, and that's what's so fascinating about it. But what does come across in all of them is that there is this tension, and that mipnei ha-machlokes is a factor, that kavod ha-brios is a factor, that kiruv is a factor, and at the same time that the projection of what is ideal to people who are already committed, the educational problem, if you will, is something that has to be considered greatly. Moshe Feinstein, for example, has many avenues of kula, which I think are even a bit radical, including in one spot, in one of the tshuvas, where he implies that one could give an aliyah to someone who was intermarried even, as long as it wouldn't be perceived by him or others as a kind of, he says one shouldn't, one should avoid it, it's nahug not to, but technically you could do it because if he's not a kofar, beikar, and he's more of a, you know, mumar l'tayavon, he says, you know, certainly give him psicha, and not just Ranam Zemiros, and then you could even give him an aliyah as well, if he, you know, if the kriya and the brachos are meaningful to him. Moreover, Mechal Shabbos, Befarhesia, somebody, you know, who's a Tinek Shenishbal, but he's still Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, even somebody who's Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia Bemezid, as long as it's L'tayavon, and he's a Mumer L'chol HaTorah Kula, you might still be able to give him an aliyah. Again, you have to worry about what he calls Chanifa, which is his way of saying, you know, are we implying that, you know, some kind of tacit assent, it doesn't bother us so much? Are we encouraging him or others that this isn't behavior that is reprehensible? You have to overcome that problem. But if you overcome that problem, from other perspectives, even though he's a mumer l'chol advarim, in other areas of halacha, he's saying maybe you can give him an aliyah, and so on. And at the same time, the same Rav Moshe Feinstein, in other tshuvas, he was asked about, you know, the child of an intermarried couple, a Jewish child of an intermarried couple, what about his bar mitzvah? And he says, I'm not sure if it's one of the ones I gave you or not, but he says, absolutely not, as long as he is connected to the parents and they are living in this rebellious state, you shouldn't give him an aliyah, maybe shouldn't have a bar mitzvah for him or acknowledge his bar mitzvah in the shul at all. The second that either they change their approach or he is separated from them, then he gets everything. The fact that his father is a non-Jew is irrelevant to his obligations and his opportunities for Avodas Hashem in these areas. But as long as he is connected to, and living in that house, and the message will then be that this is an acceptable lifestyle, absolutely not. So on the one hand, you have remarkable flexibility in kulas. I mean, this is true for almost every posek. The unpredictability of posek given these matters. If you ask, you know, this posek, generally people see him as a mekel. You know, what's his view? You should never do that in any area of halacha, because obviously the details are always more important than the orientation, although there might be orientations after the details. But in particular areas like this, where basically internally you are trying to weigh very important values, like the ones that we're discussing, it's not surprising that you'll get radical kulas and chumras from the same person, or you'll get unexpected kulas or chumras from sources that, you know, your, I guess, past experience in terms of psak may not have suggested. But the factors of machlokas, kavod abrios, chil Hashem, they register in all poskim. How they affect against, how they weigh against the others depends either on the circumstance or the way they see it, and so on. Let me just mention some of the issues demonstrating the range, and also just to identify, I think, what is a consensus in some issues and what is more controversial in others, but in the broadest way first, and then we'll turn to the other aspect of this. Some of the issues. Number one, it's important that we distinguish between different levels of non-observance. And that comes through clearly in the Makoros that you have here and in the larger Makoros of the topic. On one level, you're dealing with an avarian, I say the classical avarian who was part of any society, and any Beis HaKnesses, because in Tzadik Baaretz, everybody is an avarian one way or another. But even one who may be Pasul Eidus, and known to be an avarian, what is his status with regard to aspects of the Beis HaKnesses? With some exceptions regarding Aliyos, most of the poskim take a more inclusive posture. Again, there's a very interesting discussion regarding the Beis Yosef and Maria Buav, whether a Kohen who's married to a Grusha is disqualified from getting any Aliyah, or is only disqualified from getting Kohen. If I have time later on, I want to speak about some of the details of some of these arguments, including that one. There are those, Maria Buav and others, and some Achronim who understood the Amtsa Shlomo this way, and others as well, who understood that if he's an Avarian and he's in violation of Chai V'Lavin, and he's possibly Eidus, so he is excluded from an aliyah as well. Eidus Hashem Nemana Machimas Pesi, some of them quote that Kriyas HaTorah is a kind of an Eidus. That's how they explain, you know, or that's how it is explained in some of the Rishonim, the Or Cheskayim, why a father and a son, two brothers, shouldn't get aliyahs right next to each other because they're possibly Eidus. They can't serve as a kat. So there is a group that thinks that any Avarian, possibly Eidus, is excluded from an aliyah in the Beis HaKnesses. I mention that because it's a interesting shita, a decidedly shita siyachid. The clear consensus of the Rishonim and Achronim and modern poskim is that a regular run-of-the-mill avarian, even when it's possibly edus, we want him to do tshuva, and we're not going to let him testify, but he can be mekabel and aliyah, he can be a shliach tzibur. Again, there are factors in shliach tzibur that have to do also with chil Hashem and projecting a stature in the community, not only in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim. The Gemara in Tainus Daf Tet Zayin speaks about somebody who was an avarian benezid, you know, even after he was chozer b'tshuva, it seems like on a Tainus he shouldn't serve as a shliach tzibur. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, some of the poskim see this not only as a din in Tainus, but as a lechatzchila all year round. Maybe the Gra and others, the Ramah, Chavetz Chaim and others seem to say this is just a special halacha in Tainus, a special tshuva that's required for Tainus. But otherwise, there is no such exclusion. But of course, that's for an avarian b'mezij as a tshuva. What about an avarian she'omed b'mirdo? What would be the status then? So again, I think the majority of poskim say that you have to weigh what message you're sending him and sending others. But per se, he's not excluded as a shliach tzibur if he's a regular run-of-the-mill avarian, like many people are. You could have higher standards, but that's not the same as saying that he's osur. And with regarding to aliyos, I think this is certainly the majority of view, not just majority, I think a large majority view. As for Kohen, who marries a grusha or any other violation of kahuna, so there also seems to be a consensus, which I don't think is observed in most shuls, or necessarily, I really don't know, but in the poskim certainly, that he would not be able to receive the special kavod of the kiddashti, in other words, all the kedimos and the special kavod that a kohen receives, if he's in violation of mitzvos kahuna, then he would be excluded. If he was in violation of a regular lav, he wouldn't lose out his aliyah l'kahuna, probably. But the point is that if he's in violation of kahuna halachos, if he slaps kahuna in the face, so midrabanan is a kind of a chalal, and he loses out his opportunity to get rishon, maybe for nesias kapayim, which I'll get to in a second, as well. The Prima Gadim disagrees. Gurun takes the other position, thinking that it's quite possible that any avarian and even a kohen who is an avarian in other areas would lose aliyos in general. But I think the large consensus view is if you're speaking about a regular avarian, there's room even to give him an aliyah as long as you can get past what Rav Moshe Feinstein calls the Hanifa problem, namely the idea that you're encouraging him or at least you seem to be ignoring who he is. Yeah.
What about Kohanim with Nochios? Because on the one hand, they do have a special status in regard to them. Malchus.
Right.
On the other hand,
it's not a psul kahuna. So I think they...
But they do give Malchus even without their chasnas, at least for the Rambam.
Right. So I think that, again, that would be, I think almost most of the poskim would say you lose your Risha. Whether you lose, you know, the ability to get an aliyah per se, aside from the Hanifa problem and other problems, that I think the consensus is that it wouldn't be a problem. Sorry? The Nesias Kapayim is a little different. I'll get that in just a minute. So the Nesias Kapayim, I'll mention it now since my time is already running out, but the Nesias Kapayim is a little bit different for the following reason. Number one, the Nesias Kapayim may have a component of avoda to it. This particularly comes to the fore in discussions, I think one of which I have here, about Orel l'Nesias Kapayim. An Orel cannot be Oved, Kohen the Mikdash cannot be Oved if he's an Orel. If he does, the Avoda is Psula. An Orel can't eat Kodshim, he can't eat Truma, of course, Korban Pesach. So what about the status of an Orel in the Nesias Kapayim? So Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, in which he, I think it's not one of the ones I put down here, in which he discusses this problem and basically says, comes up with a very big lamdasha chiddush. He basically says a mumar la'arel is not a mumar l'chol ha'Torah kula. So when it comes to getting an aliyah or things of that sort, he's on the same status as every other avari. However, he says, when it comes to nesias kapayim, it might be different. His chiddush is, he thinks that arel, when it comes to avodas hamikdash, has the status of a nachir. And he wonders whether nesias kapayim, even though it isn't actual avoda b'mikdash, but l'inyan davar zeh, whether this idea of arel being ka'akum, losing kedushas Yisrael, applies or not. So that he's not fully sure about. But in terms of getting an aliyah, even aliyas kohen, that he sees not being a problem. On the other hand, the Tzitz Eliezer and Tshuva, I'm not sure, I think I put the Karoim Tshuva here, I'm not sure if I put the other one here, but in another Tshuva then, the Tzitz Eliezer has a Tshuva in which he says that he quotes Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, that maybe, you know, in general, but giving an aliyah, it's an aral, not a kohen. Forget about the Siyas Kapayim even. But Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan seemed to be note that one could give an aliyah to an aral. And Tzitz Eliezer tries to marshal a lot of evidence that he thinks it's absolutely unacceptable in every way. Feels a person is an aral, and it's, you know, he starts comparing it to Kanoim Pogimbo and other such things. You know, it's such an obvious chil Hashem that it's. That it's it would be tantamount to you know sanctioning his behavior. In his opinion, somebody who's an RL cannot receive any kibbutim in the Beis HaKnesset. So it's interesting. But the Siyas Kapayim in general, as opposed to an Aliyah, has further complications because we're talking not only about whether or not you're Mufka Mikdushas Yisrael, and, which is an issue in Aliyah, whether or not the Brachos and the Kriya is meaningful such that you can be Motzei Acherim B'dei Chavasan, which is a separate point. A point that Moshe Feinstein very much zeroes in on. But in the Siyas Kapayim, in addition to that, you have the Avoda element, and you also have the Mevarech Es Yisrael element. To be Mevarech Es Yisrael, you have to have a certain stature and a certain status. And this is evident by the fact that, a Kohen Haragas HaNefesh, even if he, you know, B'shogeg, maybe if he did Tshuva, or Obed Avodah Zarah, B'asa Tshuva, is a debate among the Rishonim based on the Sugyas and Sota and so on. Things that, you know, in any other area of halacha would be considered Yisrael, full Kedusha l'chol davar, and would be fully equipped to, you know, to proceed and to participate. But when it comes to Birchas Kohanim, which is a bracha, he's excluded. So that may raise the bar a little bit in the Siyas Kapayim when it comes to these issues. So there are regular violations, our kahuna violations, which have an issue in their own right. There is the Siyas Kapayim. Then there is Avarian and Mumar L'Tayavam. I'm just going to go for another 5 minutes and then we'll go to the next phase. Avarian and Mumar L'Tayavam. Again, here, the general consensus is, again, aside from the question of being Mechabed Avarianim, which is never a good thing in its own right, this question is whether it's perceived that way and what the alternative is. If you're talking about Hanifa or Chil Hashem, you know, which Chil Hashem is greater. So there is always that issue. But in terms of the status of Kedushas Yisrael, of such a person, such that he can, you know, receive an aliyah, that we view him as a Yisrael, l'chol davar, that he can be motzei acher midei kolbasan and brachos, and so on and so forth, as far as that is concerned, most people accept the formulation of the Shach and Yoredei and others, that mumar l'tayavon, even a mumar l'avodah zarah l'tayavon, even a mumar l'shabbos l'tayavon, is not a goy. He does have some Kedushas Yisrael. And aside from him from coordinating the details, he would be accepted for participation b'di'evet. Here there comes another issue when it comes to Aliyos. The Sefer Hasidim already discusses this problem. There are different forms of it. And that is there any problem giving somebody an Aliyah in Shul pertaining to a subject matter that he violates? Right. If he is, always mevaze samoadim, so you can give him a parsh, can you give him an aliyah in parshas emor, in parshas samoadim or not? If he is known to be in violation of dini arayos, can you call him up in achremos? You know, if he's not very good at kibud avim, can you give him the aliyah of ben sora mora? So that's an interesting question. Although again, the range is again very fascinating and informative. On some levels, this is formulated by Rishonim and then later Poskim, in terms of if he's a Vadei Avarian, maybe Dafka you should give it to him. It'll spark his renewed interest in the topic and inspire him to tshuva. On the contrary, the reason not to give it to him, according to some Poskim, is Habonas Panav Barabim. Everybody knows this is what he's doing. So we don't want to give him the aliyah because, everybody's going to be smirking and pointing fingers at him. And though we want him to do tshuva, we don't want to drive him away. And then, of course, there's the third perspective, which is, it would be hypocritical. It's just, it's one thing to say that such a person can participate in Beis HaKnesses, aside from the other issues. It's quite something else, to make the Kriyas HaTorah, or wherever it is, into a chucho tlula by having this guy put his talus over his head, you know, and make a very slow Birchas HaTorah, you know, as they're reading all about his violation. So I think these three perspectives, all of which we can document in the poskim, are symptomatic, you know, of the kind of considerations that that we have to go through. When it comes to Mumer Lahachis and Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya, Lahachis, or Apikores, so here, of course, are two issues. One is how to define it. And in that, in the poskim, there's tremendous range. And in two senses. Number one, what do you do to qualify to get that status? We don't want you to get that status, but what do you have to do to be in that status? And then, of course, how much Tinok Shenishba do we automatically apply to Zmanenu? You know, what does it mean to be Mechal Shabbos Befarhesya as a Mumer Lahachis? What exactly does that entail? That's one part of the discussion. The second part of the discussion is whether or not that is determinative. In other words, we say that Mumer Lahachis or Apikores or Mumer Lechal Shabbos Befarhesya is Kegoy with regard to Shechita and his Yai Nesech. Is that only Chumras, or is it also what we call neutral or Kulas? In other words, does that mean that he's Potter from coming to Shul and getting an aliyah? How do you weigh calling this person Ka'akum with Yisrael Afa Bishachata Yisrael, which of course is an old issue? You know, is get is a get, is kedushin is a kedushin, is chalitza a chalitza? Again, in the Rishonim already struggled with these problems. And here also this comes up, and you find quite a range at that. Rav Herzog, in one of his tshuvas, says, you know, I'm not really sure that we even pask in this way, that he's a mumar l'chal tar kula. But even if he is, maybe it's l'kula, maybe it's l'chumra, not l'kula. Rav Sternbach also, in one of his tshuvas, talks about there's not going to be a minyan in some of these shuls in Johannesburg unless you count people who, you know, whose yayin, maga yayin is yayin nesach, and whose shechita is possible according to the objective categories of the halacha. Can they form a minyan or not? But if there's no minyan, and he has a line where he says, you know, lo yitachet, that's not conceivable, it's just not... It's not palatable that there's not going to be a minyan in these big cities, because this is the only way to make it. We, by which he means, not that we're going to throw out all of halacha because it's an unacceptable conclusion, but his halachic intuition tells him that this is an unacceptable conclusion, and therefore there has to be within halacha some way to justify this. So he too discusses the problem. Somebody can be, you know, kemumar l'chol haTorah kula in one sense, and at the same time, he's still a member of Klal Yisrael. The way the Rav Herzog puts it, Rav Herzog says, a ger is, the problem of a ger is a full member of Klal Yisrael, but when it comes to matters that have to do with his father being a member of Klal Yisrael, there are issues. He's not a Ben Yisrael, in a literal, he's part of Am Yisrael, but he's not a Ben Yisrael. That's why you sometimes need Ribuyim to tell you that certain halachos apply to a ger, because his father didn't have the experience of Bikurim and other such issues and so on. He says a mumar has the opposite status, right? In one respect, he's not behaving like a Yisrael, but he's a Ben Yisrael. So certain halachos that depend on his being a member of Klal Yisrael by virtue of the fact that his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather were members in good standing too. Which halachos depend on which when it comes to those issues? Or another way to formulate the problem, he says, listen, in the world of karbanos, for which tefillah is patterned, so we say, you know, a mumar l'chol haTorah kula, even a mumar l'davar echad, might be mufka from karbanos. And after all, tefillah is keneged tmidin, the Beis HaKnesses is a migdash ma'at, says Rav Herzog. But at the same time, he says, those all focus on individual acts. Basically, what we want to know is, can person X, who's an avarian in this and that way, can he bring a karban or not? Here we're talking about whether or not Avarian A can be mitzarev to be part of Klal Yisrael, to be part of the Davar Shemekdusha, to be part of the Minyan. Under those conditions, it's quite possible that we look at his stature and his status in a different way. Some years ago, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, I gave a shiur, and I think he subsequently wrote it in his sefer, or maybe an article in Beis Yitzchak. He had almost an opposite view of Rav Herzog of these issues. I'm putting them in conjunction. I don't know that he would have disagreed factually, but his argument was that a mumar who is ka'akum, a mishumad, for example, inyan individual aspects, I'm not talking about Shabbos Parhesia, that's much less. I'm talking about a real apikoros, or mishumad, let's say, who is kegoy. He said, with regard to individual aspects of Kedushas Yisrael, we say Yisrael Afa Bishachata Yisrael. What he really loses is as good standing as a member of Klal Yisrael, which is why some poskim thought that such a person needs tvila before he can marry a Jew. And so he needs a kind of mixas geirus together with his tshuva. So all these, the lavdasha issues, one might call them. What is the status of a mumar, ka'akum, is it kula, is it chumra, as a yachid, as a tzibur, in either direction, as a ben Yisrael, as a Yisrael? These issues very much come into play when it comes to the issues at hand. On the other hand, Moshe Feinstein, as I mentioned before, has this remarkable kula. It's a chumra and a kula at the same time, where basically he argues when it comes to an aliyah and things of that sort, that the issue isn't whether he has Kedushas Yisrael in other areas of halacha. He might, shchitaso could be no shchita, and yeno may be yai nesek. He says the real question is, when he makes a bracha, does it have any meaning for him? Is he saying words? Does he treat it as a neutral or secular text? In which case, it's a bracha labatala for anyone who hears him. They shouldn't say amen to his bracha. And that could be true even if he's not a mamar l'chol devareha. Let's say he's a shomer shabbos kihil chasa, but he doesn't believe. I guess he is a mumar in a different way. But the point is that even if we're not, if such a person is excluded, and a person who is in the category of goy l'chol davar, but you know, he has a little shemetz in the street, he believes in Rabbanu Shel Olam. That's what's pointed about Yom Kippur. People come to Shul Yom Kippur. They're over every Aveira in the book. But they come to Yom Kippur because they believe in a way. Right? So when they get it, whether you should give them an Ali is a different question. That's the Hanifa issue. You know, whether it should be mechabinim is a different question. But can you? Is it a bracha levatala? Can he be yotze with his kriyas haTorah? Can he be yotze with his bracha? His argument is yes. That has nothing to do with the general question of tinok shenishba. You can have it the other way too. You have a tinok shenishba who is mechal Shabbos b'farhesia. So you won't say that he's a goy l'chol davar. But he's an atheist. He grew up in the Soviet Union. He doesn't believe in God at all. Somebody drags him in the shul and somebody wants to give him an aliyah. So Moshe Feinstein says he can't do it. We're sympathetic for the fellow. You know, he's not a Michal Shabbos Parhesia Benezid Lahakis at all. But the fact is, what is the meaning of his bracha? And others say this as well. He's going to say Asher Bachabana Mikol Amim and Asalana West Haraso, and you're going to say Amen to that bracha when it's a mockery. He doesn't mean it. It doesn't have any meaning for him. So the point is that it's complex. These are some of the issues. So Chilul Shabbos Parhesia, Kofar, these issues are very complicated. Then there's the intermarried Jew, who on a pure Avarian level might be less than Mechal Shabbos Parhesia, and so on. But on another level, in terms of Chilul Hashem, as I mentioned, and in terms of the impact of acknowledging him, and you know, thereby implying that, you know, intermarriage doesn't disqualify you from membership in Klal Yisrael and identification, that becomes a more complicated issue as well. The one area makar in halacha which is clear about not giving somebody an aliyah or tefillah and so on is nidui. Many of the poskim are medayik from the fact that only nidui seems to be menuda, seems to be excluded from these things. That, you know, we don't, on the lists of things that are subject to aliyah, ketanim and isha, kavodat tzibur, but it doesn't say ksheirim, it doesn't have, it's not a list like psulei eidos and so on. A lot of the posts can point to the fact it's only mishahu menuda that can't get an aliyah and so on. So, you know, the question is whether an intermarried person doesn't have almost the equivalent status of a menuda in our time. By which I mean, he isn't technically menuda, obviously, but in the sense that, you know, he's persona non grata in the Jewish community. He's like, we don't just view it as an avarian. And here I should just add a historical note. Certainly this was true in the mid-70s, I would say. I don't know, it's hard to know where to draw the line. Or 80s. Where even for non-affiliated Jews marrying outside the faith, in terms of the numbers that were doing it and in terms of their understanding of what it meant, was an act of absolute rebellion and turning your back on Jewish identity, not just on religion. Unfortunately, because of all of that, things have escalated considerably. It no longer has the same meaning to marry outside the faith. It's no longer an act of rebellion. It's no longer a taboo. Ad hechan higanu, we've reached the point where, you know, people don't think it's asur or they know it's asur, but again, it's, you know, I can give to the UJA and support Israel and maybe want to get an aliyah in the shul, even though I'm intermarried. That wasn't so 20 years ago, but it might be so today. whether that changes things or makes our need to be vigilant and to make the point that we don't accept this or people like this in any way, I'm not sure. I think it's a question for assessment. But the case of intermarriage, or a masur, somebody who, you know, who clearly turns his back on the Jewish community, I think that falls into the issue or the under the rubric of menuda in one respect more than other things. And finally, just to note, and then of course there's RL that I mentioned, and there are other issues as well. These are all different halachic status in Kedushas Yisrael, and they're all different in terms of applying to these issues. At the same time, there are different issues and applications which also need to be distinguished. There is membership in a shul, membership in the board, membership, being president of a shul, which may be touch on the question of minui and srara, but even more so has symbolic value, what you want to project as values to the community. It's one issue. Moshe Feinstein has a nice tshuva about that, about Yerushalayim, being a sine qua non for minui. But I think very much depends on what the community is like and who this avarian is and so on and so forth. Then there's the questions of being mechabed within the shul. And here, as we already noted, the Siyas Kapayim has its particular challenges. Aliyah has its. Being a shliach tzibur is still yet another category. And giving somebody psicha, you know, or hagba or galila is obviously a lot less problematic. So these are some of the tzir flaminion, I think is a very interesting issue, not spoken of so much. I'll take a question just one more second. Because on the one hand, it's what creates a davar shebekedusha, and therefore it might require a certain kedushas yisrael of a higher level. Although, and again, the comments of Rav Herzog, which are, this may, you know, be kind of batel b'miut, in the sense that, well, we don't need you to make the minyan. The minyan is made up of the totality. The relationship between who can get an aliyah and who can make up a minyan is sometimes, you know, interchangeably dealt with by some of the poskim. In my opinion, they might be really two completely different issues. If you look at the material itself, then I'll take the question and then I'll turn it over to the next part. I think that many poskim are very flexible on these issues, up to the point that they can't be. And again, there are two issues. The Chilul Hashem, Chanipa considerations, what impact is this going to have on others and on our values is one crucial issue. And then for many of them, the bottom line is Kedushas Yisrael. I mentioned some of the exceptions, but for many of them, the bottom line is Kedushas Yisrael when it comes to things like Shliach Tzibur and Aliyah. But I think we do find the tendency within what is flexible, as long as we're not undermining standards, for Kiruv, much more so than for the standard. And that itself is a very crucial perspective. So one question first, and then I'm going to, yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's very good that you, again, Rav Shurmach's Chuvas, he's very big on this. He says, my strategy here in Johannesburg is if I have to give an aliyah to somebody who's problematic, I try not to. And if I have to, I give him a hosafa beyond the Zion Kruv. Because at least then, you yotze the Kriyas HaTorah. There still might be a question of bracha levatala, but at least you were yotze the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah. So that's a very good point.
Right, but even if there's a problem bracha levatala in that case, like for example, the kids or even the 8 kids that came from the Soviet Union or whatever.
Right.
I mean, by giving them aliyah, like United Spark or something, make them want to come back. Like, oh, look how, like, you know, they accept.
Right. So he's saying those are part of the considerations of wanting to give it. So if you want to give them an aliyah, you want to encourage his participation, but it's more problematic to give him the first 7 kruim. So then he that's his compromise. Again, Moshe Feinstein, you know, short of Apikores, you know, whose brachos and kriya and relationship to Torah is totally neutral or meaningless, will allow you, if you can overcome the Chanipa problem, even to give an aliyah within the Zayin kruim. And the same thing are Rav Avadya Yosef and some of the others. Okay, balancing, you know, what message you're giving, but it's within the flexible parameters of it's permitted. Now the question is it desirable? Well, it depends. I don't want to send a bad message, but I want to be makariv. Then it's going to depend. If you look at Moshe's tshuvas, it's interesting. In some of them, he's almost saying you can do it, it's no problem, and in others, he's saying you can't do this unless b'di'evad under these. Clearly, he's talking about different situations, maybe even a different time, to different people, and it's within the flexible range of doable things. Kofar can't get an aliyah, in his opinion, ever. My first segment might disagree, but, you know, but, and certain things are fine to do always, and certain things you have to keep weighing back and forth. The, yeah.
We're just talking about all the substances, only Masal, Shabbos, Frenzer, or Frenzer versus Verzer. Not Frenzer, Tegeza.
I think I was making a distinction between different categories of avaryanim. What I was saying was, if a person is just chaybe lavin, and he's possibly avis, almost no one's going to take away his aliyah. And certainly not anything else. If he's a kohen and he's violating his kahuna, most people are going to take away his kohen aliyah. If he, you know, is a mumar l'teyavon, not l'hachis, or he's Mechal Shabbos, but, you know, not Befarhesia, let's say. You know, and he doesn't have the status of losing Kedushas Yisrael in other areas, like Shechita and Yain Nesach and so on. Then again, most of the poskim are not going to take away his aliyah.
So it's more.
They're going to say, don't encourage him, that's something else. The problem is, if he's really lost his Kedushas Yisrael according to the normal rules, as evidenced by Shechita, Yain Nesach, and so on and so on, what about Le'inyan matters of the Beis HaKnesses? Is there a difference in Kula and Chomra? Is there a difference between knowing what you're saying and still not meaning it? Even, you know, people are crazy, you know, sometimes people are strange. They can, you know, be Mumar Lahakis, and then they can still have a belief in their Baruch Shalom and Halakha in some way. You know? So that's where the tension comes in. And you clearly have maximalists and minimalists. There's a Tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi that I have here as well, where he's like, you know, goes ballistic. You're going to give guys an Avari, you're going to give him Aliyahs, how could you do that? Then his son, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writes a tshuva in which he says, hey, you can give the guy, as long as he's not a kofar or beikar, he says, you can give the guy an aliyah, it's no problem. He says, my father's tshuva. Oh, no, he meant an inveterate, you know, avarian, who's always mechal shem shamai, would be such a chil Hashem when the guy, if you read the Chacham Tzvi's tshuva, you don't get the impression that it's so limited. The son, you know, was interpreting the father, you know, accurately or not accurately. You know, in a certain way. So what I'm trying to show is that there is a range. Everybody's dealing with the issues. Everybody's trying to tension. I think there's a general consensus to be makil in certain things. And as for the thornier question of somebody who loses his Kedushas Yisrael, there I think there really is a debate. I think one can rely on the makilim if for the right reasons, after weighing the issues and trying to limit it as much as possible. But, you know, there is a significant debate on it. Yeah.
Avoiding encouragement, according to Moshe, does that mean giving the person the opportunity not to be mechala? Is that what it means to avoid encouraging the person?
He's not talking about that, like inviting somebody over for Shabbos, you know, but making sure that they can stay over, the kind of thing.
But even so, trying to say to this person.
He means, let's say, he says, listen, there's a Jewish doctor, you know, and he's intermarried, or he's doing some other aveira. But he's a very wonderful man. I mean, he does tremendous things for the community. He volunteers his time. He's a great healer. Mm-hmm. So you want to give him he comes to shul, you want to acknowledge the contribution that he's made to the community. He says, I don't want him to walk away, or the people to walk away, thinking that we're being mechabed him and saying, you know, he's a wonderful doctor. The fact that he's mechal Shabbos, or he's living with a non-Jew, or he's intermarried, doesn't matter. He's a wonderful doctor. That's chanifa. That's osur. And then he discusses when it's yoharik v'yavor and when it's just osur, and he has criteria for that as well. He says, but if it's clear to everybody that I'm honoring him for his humanitarian deeds, or I'm trying to encourage him to become closer to halacha, and that's why I'm being mechabed him, and he is a person for whom, you know, he's not a kofar b'ikar, whose kriyas haTorah is meaningless. So he says, so then you can, under those conditions, it's the right thing to give him an aliyah. That's what he's referring to. Now, of course, when you really want to do kiruv, that's a separate question. It's not about the Beis HaKnesses only. When you want to do kiruv, and, you know, what is your responsibility to ensure that at least there's the possibility of maximal standards in the context of that? And that goes back to what you said before. Because, A, it's the halakhically right and maybe only way to do it, A. And B, because, ironically, the mixed signals of saying to somebody, come, drive to shul, we don't care as long as we get you. What are you saying to that fellow? Are you saying to him you can pick and choose in halacha? Are you saying, you know, that davening and saying, Amin Heshmi Rabbah is more important than Chilul Shabbos? So you have to be careful in your kiruv. You know, just it's an internal kiruv matter. Never mind the relationship between values and kiruv. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to the to Avi Mori for the next stage. And again, I'm sorry I took up so much time. The father is always more brief.
We would have achieved a tremendous amount. Let me just very quickly give you my own background. Back in 1950, that sounds a little long, it was a little old, but back in 1950, I received smicha from the yeshiva here. I'm a product of yeshiva fully in every sense of the word, very proud of it. And then I was in the rabbinate for 47 years before I retired from the rabbinate, stayed active still here, of course. But I spent 18 years in Toronto, where I was actually born, as a matter of fact, and 29 years in Kew Gardens. I have to tell you, before I get into the details of that and some of the problems that were raised by my son here, and they are extremely complex. The word complex that he used is the simplest way to put it, because you could put it with a big C and you'd be correct in regards to that. I found, for example, in 47 years, I encourage anyone who is even the slightest interest to go into the Rabbanus. I found it to be, on the one hand, the most frustrating, but at the same time, the most challenging and the most satisfying part of my life. Everything I expected out of the rabbinate, ultimately, I really did get. If you really want to go into Rabbanus, the key is that you have to consider it to be literally a mission and a calling without any kind of qualification whatsoever. You have to know that you're going to have problems, you're dealing with human beings. You also have to realize that you're never going to have a shul where everyone agrees with you. Unanimity doesn't exist. If it did, there's something wrong with you. So that much is a reality. So if you do that, that's what. On the other hand, you also have to realize that there's a difference between the ideal and the real. You strive for the ideal, but you have to deal with the real. And you have to keep that in mind constantly. And adding to that, I consider to be really the most important factor in all of this is the ability to use the fifth Shulchan Aruch, which of course you know what the fifth Shulchan Aruch is, the Seichel HaYosher. Seichel HaYosher is extremely important in the rabbinate. You're dealing with all kinds of situations, and you have to be able to use it, you have to balance it together with your sense of, there are two things. Number one, as long as the Seichel HaYosher operates, as long as it doesn't impinge on very basic halacha, that's number one. There you have to stand firm no matter what. And at the same time, there's another aspect, and as I was listening to all these various problems and these possibilities, and there are times when you have to ideologically, beyond the halacha, there is such a thing as an ideological commitment. And that ideological commitment on the part of the rabbi has to come out. And it requires, number one, that as you deal with people, while you're reaching out to them, they have to know what you stand for. There can be no pussyfooting around in that particular area. If you do, you're not going to make it. That's not the way it works in the rabbinate. I don't think it works in any part of life, for that matter. But people have to know who you are. That doesn't prevent you from reaching out to people and saying, I understand who you are and I understand your problem. But at the same time, the fact of the matter is that if you do, you're not going to make it at all. That also, the other thing is that there may be certain things that either are permissible or not permissible fully in that sense, but from an ideological point of view, you have to take a stand in a certain direction in order to be able to maintain a certain standard. And that's not an easy thing. I'll come to that as we move along, but you'll understand that as we go along. Having said that, when I went through the following phases. When I came to Toronto, my shul had, in the shul that I had, probably 10% of the balabatim in that shul were shomeshach. I used to have in shul, so you understand what you're dealing with. In those, and by the way, today much has changed, but for people, for example, who were going to the rabbinate and were going to some of the areas outside of New York, this is still true to a certain degree. It hasn't changed from that point of view. When I came to Toronto, for example, the first week I came, or the second week I came, one of the few people who were really Shomer Shabbos in the shul came to me and said to me, "Rabbi, there's a problem. You have to handle it." I was all of 23 years old. I don't know at the time when I started. So I said to him, "What's the problem?" So he says, "What are you going to do about the express minyan?" Now, you know about an Ashkama minyan, correct? You know about an Ashkama minyan. But I also found that later on, we used to deal with Ashkama. I had an Ashkama minyan in my shul. But someone's express minyans, I said, "What do you mean an express minyan?" So he says, "Rabbi, it means the following, that every Shabbos morning, there is a group of people that come in early in the morning. The davening is over in an hour and a half." So I said, "So what's wrong with that?" He says, "But you don't understand." He says, "These people are coming, not one of them is a Shomer Shabbos. They're all Mechalei Shabbos. They want to say Kaddish. So they're coming in early to say Kaddish and then go to work." So this offended him. So I said to him, "I don't understand. These people come during the week to daven." He said, "Yes, they do come to during the week. These people come to daven as well, because they're saying Kaddish." So I understood, even at 23 years old, that you don't throw these people out. You don't do that. With 10% of the people, anyways, in your shul, were nothing more than frum. And even then, sometimes I could have questioned some of their frumkeit. I had balabatim used to come to daven on Shabbos morning, finished davening, took off their talis, walked around the block to the main street on the thing, and opened up their businesses. And they consider themselves to be good Orthodox Jews in that particular context. So what we did, so I said to them, "There's no way that I will cancel the express minyan. On the contrary, but I will use the express minyan." What I used to do as a result of that, and this is really where you come out, I used to go down to that express minyan. It was my predecessor, who was a wonderful rabbi, but there, never bothered with them. He had to do it, he did it as a matter of, you know, necessity. But he really didn't relate to them. I decided that the best thing to do was to go down there. I would go down there once every 2 or 3 weeks, before I went to shul, before the regular davening, just to speak to them. And to speak, I would give them a little drasha on the seder of the week. Now, I don't know whether I made tremendous inroads with these people, but I do know that it made a difference to many of them, because they would come up to me afterwards to thank me, even though I added 10 minutes to the davening, which meant that they left 10 minutes later than they would have ordinarily have left. Nonetheless, the fact remains that this became an important part of their lives. And I had people who subsequently, as a result of this, after they were finished saying Kaddish, you know, you're through with the 11 months and the less a day, it's finished. So some of them used to come to shul, some more regularly, some less regularly. And that was the reality of it. When I was in the first part of my rabbinate in Toronto, later on, the last half of my rabbinate, I had 40% when we moved into a new area. We had 40% of the people in my shul were Orthodox. It was already a different ball game. When I came to Kew Gardens, there were even more. I mean, that's the way my world developed. But the truth of the matter is, for example, who's going to be president of a shul of this kind? Are you going to insist that an Orthodox Jew be president of that kind of synagogue? There was no way. There wasn't a single during that phase of my rabbinate. Not a single one of my presidents was a Shomer Shabbos in the sense that you and I know it. He came to shul Shabbos. That was, no, how could he not come to shul? He was the president. So he would come to shul in each case. You know, he had no really, whether he desired to or didn't desire to, he knew he had to come. That much he knew, being a president of an Orthodox shul, he had to show up. So these people would show up. But they had no sense of what Orthodoxy was about. The truth of the matter is, you had to accept that. But I also had, a cousin who was, I think, a Shomer Shabbos, he never caught him doing anything. I always had my certain reservations. But I used him, I'll be very frank with you, I used him a great deal Because I didn't want someone, I'm going to come to that in a few minutes, I didn't want someone who was not a Mechal, not a Shomer Shabbos, to go to the Omer as much as possible. In those years, I couldn't help it at all. And the end result was that someone who, particularly on Shabbos, and during the week we'll talk again, but on Shabbos particularly, I felt Shabbos and Yom Tov, these were special kinds of situations. And it needed an extra dimension of Kedusha. And not everyone was worthy of going to the Omid in that kind of circumstance. That was really my thinking. Whether it would be technically permissible or not is a question you just heard discussed. But the fact is, in reality, I had to deal with certain realistic things. I wanted to impose a certain kind of atmosphere. And the end result was that during that phase of my life, I was only able to achieve that reality up to a certain point. Not fully. I wouldn't do that. But you do as much as you can without hurting anybody from that particular point of view. As a matter of fact, what I bemoaned in the latter part of my rabbinate was the fact that the shul that I had in Kew Gardens, after a relatively short period of time, I think was 99 and like ivory soap was 99 and 44, 100% of the Shabbos. I mean, that it was to that extent, and I missed the fact that there were non-Orthodox people, because I was able to reach out to these people, and I did it by never compromising myself, never compromising my principles at all, and that's extremely important. But at the same time, saying, look, I care about you. From that particular point, I care about you, and I want you to do even better. I had a situation once in my shul that I had a member in my shul. I had a member in my shul who came from a very Orthodox home. So you'll understand what I mean by dealing with non-Orthodox people. I remember him. He came from non-Orthodox. His father was a sheikhet, as a matter of fact, a very Orthodox soul. But he let it. He came from Winnipeg. He let it all drop. Anyways, he came to Toronto. He became very successful. Became a very successful businessman. He married. After he married, he had some kind of hirhure tshuva. He had hirhure tshuva. So he lived in my area. So he used to come to shul. He used to take his car, even though he could have walked. I mean, this was the Mishigah. So he took his car, and he parked it about 2 blocks away from the shul. That was the... And slowly but surely, he became more, personally more religious as a human being. So he decided on Sukkot. In those years, not everybody had a lulav and esrog. Today, if you don't have a lulav and esrog, there's something wrong with you. But in my time, not everybody had a lulav and esrog. On the contrary, very few people had. The shul had a lulav and esrog. The rabbi had a lulav and esrog. A few other people had it, if you remember. That was the reality. Anyways, but he was a wealthy man. He really had money. So he bought himself a lulav and esrog. But he had forgotten a lot of what he had known. So so one of my more Orthodox balabatim, and this to me was what do you call it? So he comes running into shul. This is Shabbos Chol HaMoed, Sukkot. He comes running into shul and he says, X, this fellow just got out of his car. He has a lulav and esrog in his hand, and he's so happy. He's so happy. Here they're gonna, what do you call it? So I hear this. So I said to myself, this poor guy, he's trying his best. He's trying to improve. Yeah, you have to help him improve. Imagine, he'll walk through that door with the lulav and the esrog in his hand. They're going to embarrass him. He's going to be so embarrassed, he'll never come back to shul again. So I sent out the trustee. You have to do this all the time. I'm just trying to show you the necessity for how to deal with non-Orthodox people. I sent out the trustee. I says, you run out, you get hold of Lou as quickly as possible, and you tell him to put the lulav and esrog back in the car. The rabbi said so. What are you going to do? Otherwise, he would have taken it. So he put it back, and nothing happened. Later on, years later, he found out about it. About 3 or 4 years later, he found out that I had done it. He came to me, and he says, you know, you saved me. And he says, if I had come in that door, he told this to me, if I had walked through that door, and that's the way it would have been, I would have left this place, and I would never have come back again. The end result of this man, as a result, and I'm just telling it to you, is that in a matter of 5 or 6 years after this whole incident, he became a full Shemesh Rabbis. As a matter of fact, his son is a Musmuch of Merkez Harav, to that extent. Not a small thing. And only all you have to do is to keep your eyes open in that respect. You have to deal with these people on that particular level, otherwise you're not going to... The fact is that the president was not orthodox. Most of the members of the board were not orthodox. But they realized that the rabbi was orthodox and that the shul had to be orthodox. That was the key. And the result is that you're able to reach out. Sometimes you don't reach out so much to the parent as you do to the child in the non-orthodox community. We used to have... You see, today it sounds almost ludicrous to you, but because you're not used to it, unless you come from a certain background. But the truth of the matter is, we used to have a Sunday morning tefillin club. The kids who came to this tefillin club, 90% of them were not Orthodox, didn't come from Orthodox homes. But over a period of time, by reaching out to these people, you were able to establish a certain kind of relationship. And some of these kids, I'm not saying that all of them, but I think about 20-odd% of these kids ultimately, in their own lives, became Shomer Shabbos, slowly but surely. I had one Bala Boss who used to come every week with his car. Slowly but surely, he came from Europe originally. He was not. He was born in Poland. Slowly but surely, he came back. And then, when he was practically a full Shomer Shabbos, he moved out of the area. He moved out of the area, and this is where the other part of dealing with people is concerned. You have to be honest, you have to be... ego is not an important thing in this matter. On the contrary, if you use your ego, then you're in trouble. So, 2 weeks later, I look up, and this fellow is in shul. Now, he couldn't possibly have walked to the shul. There was no way. He lived about 3 miles or 4 miles from the shul. He wasn't a youngster. So after it was over, after Shabbos was over, he came up, he gave me what he called. I said, oh, I said, very nice, very nice. I said, that was a long walk. So he said to me, no, Rabbi, he says, I drove. So I said to him, but you become a Shomer Shabbos over a period of time. So he said to me, well, he says, I'd love to hear your sermons. You know, the ego sounds good. That sounds good. Yeah, you know, to hear a sermon. So I looked at him and I smiled, and I said to him, "Listen, I'm very grateful that you love to hear my sermons, but it's more important," I said, "that you should be a Shomer Shabbos." I said, "You'll find another rabbi up there." I said, "But I tell you, but if you come down here in order just to hear my sermons and you drive a car and you're called Shabbos, you're doing me more harm than you're doing yourself good." And the fact is, he never came to the shul again. He joined an Orthodox shul up there and lived the rest of his life as an Orthodox Jew. So you have to know when to use your ego and not to use your ego. But that's the basis. If you keep at it, you're going to find that this, in fact, is the case. Later on, when we moved into the upper new area, later on, what do you call it? It was a completely different ballgame. There already I had a whole core of young Balabatim who were absolutely dedicated to orthodoxy in every sense of the word. There you could do other things. Though it was not in the Constitution, it was generally understood that there should be more orthodox participation. Nobody could go to the Omid if he wasn't a Shomer Shabbos on Shabbos. On Shabbos, this was the case. At the same time, there were, in other words, the shul was 40% orthodox, but 60% non-orthodox. So you have two things going at the same time. You have to deal with the Orthodox community. They can be sometimes harder to deal with than non-Orthodox people in certain respects. But at the same time, you're dealing with the 60% that are non-Orthodox. You have to maintain two levels. You have to maintain your principles, and at the same time, you have to reach out to them. On the one hand, for example, when I was building, we built a shul in the Round, a beautiful shul in Toronto, really, really beautiful shul. I literally raised 90% of the money. And I used to go, but these people, there were all kinds of people there. So at one point, two of the richest Balabatim that we had in the shul, were not Orthodox. They came to me and they said to me, look, we're ready to give you $25,000 each. Now in those years, $25,000 was a lot of money. And on condition, and that is that no mechitza. I said, their wives, they're not happy, they don't want a mechitza. They can have separate seating, but you can't have a mechitza. So I said, listen, I would love to do it for you, but I can't. I says, I'm bound by to use a Hebrew national expression, by a higher authority. You know, I'm answerable, just as you're answerable to your wives, I'm answerable to God. I said, so there's no way that we can do it. They left the shul. We built the shul anyways, from that point of view. So it's easy to make these mistakes. On the other hand, for example, we had, when it came to Balei Tefillah, you're going to think I'm a tremendous machmir, but the truth of the matter is, we already reached a stage at that point in my shul where we could afford to do these things. Because I felt it wasn't a matter just of halacha, it was also a statement that had to be made. The reform and the conservative movement was very strong, and generally was quite strong in Toronto. So there was, for example, I had one balabos who was my neighbor. He lived right across the street from me. And he he was a Shomer Shabbos, except for one thing. That was Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. He liked the daven, he loved the yomid. So Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he would go daven in a conservative temple. He loved the yomid. He was a member of the shul, and he was my neighbor right across the street, directly across the street from me. So I thought about it. I said, look, you better tell Percy, his name, first name was Percy. I bet I can tell you his last name. Tell you, but his first name, first I said, you can tell Percy that this is not acceptable. All right, so he, the next year he went off and he davened again in this conservative temple. I called over the Gaboyev and I said, he can't go to the Yomid. Now, you heard technically they're all, he hears of Shomer Shabbos in every other respect, but it was important to make a statement in terms of the community. That they had to realize that there is a distinction between the Orthodox and the conservative, and particularly in a city like Toronto and at that particular time. So I wouldn't allow him to daven. I didn't allow him to daven. But anyways, this went on for 2 years. Then he came to me and he said, Rabbi, please forgive me. I won't go again. I said, fine, Percy, I accept it. And I gave the Gaboyim an order and said to them, let him down. So he did. And this happened, this went on for 2 years. Then I found out after 2 years that he went to there was a senior citizens, what we call them, what we used to call them, a senior citizens hall right near the shul. So he went there for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and that place they couldn't care less. So men and women sat together, and of course, there are always people to tell you right away. So I had people who reported right back to me, you know what Percy did? This is what he did. So I said, if that's the case, he's through. Anyways, he came. So he came across. It was his sukkah time. You were sitting there. He came across sukkah time to me, and he said to me, Rabbi, he says, I didn't realize when I went there what it was going to be. So he says, but you have to understand, I did a lot of good there. So I said, what was the good that you did? He says, people who were blind, he says, and when they heard me daven, began to see. He says, and people who couldn't walk began to walk. So I said, Percy, I said, the Ribbono Shel Olam will give you your schar. But for me, you lost it. So you see what he called it. But certainly when it came to non-Orthodox people, we never allowed them to go to the Yomid. I even went further than non-Orthodox people. First of all, Bram, you wanted to ask something.
Yeah, in a show where you have, let's say, only 10% Orthodox.
Correct.
People. So how do you cater to the needs and the desires of your Orthodox communists and provide services for them?
That's a good question.
At the same time,
what I did
both financially, and also how do you make sure that the rest of the show doesn't feel uncomfortable with everything that you're doing?
Because I used to provide, for example, I gave a Gemara every week to them. that nobody else attended except the five or six people who had an Orthodox background. I made sure that wherever the opportunity presented itself, and one of these people could daven, that he had an opportunity to go to the Omid and to daven. And I singled him out in that respect. So he would be aware of the fact that I'm appreciative of the fact that he comes from an Orthodox background. In those years, you have to count them on your hands, and you were very grateful that you had this kind of person, Balabos, in your community. You didn't have that many, but whatever you had, these are the ones that you encouraged. Generally speaking, the tone of all of the lectures, I used to give lectures all the time. As you know, I love to talk. I used to give all kinds of classes. That was one of my strengths in the rabbinate. I made sure that the tenor of all my talks, no matter what happened, in the end, always moved in the direction of commitment. And this made them feel exclusive in that particular sense, because they felt they already reached it. And at the same time, it provided some of my other balabatim with something to think about. When it comes to, incidentally, when it came to Elias, etc., what I always did, when it came to Elias, I was very liberal, particularly for people who have your side. Otherwise, you're going to drive people away. The reasoning that I used basically was that when a person goes to the Torah, he has there here hurray tshuva there, and he's going to act properly. And I was very, very careful with that, except in one or two cases. For example, you talked about, I had a situation where a Kohen married a Grusha. And I warned him ahead of time that he's making a mistake religiously. Anyways, the result was he married her. He was not permitted. In my shul, he was not permitted to get an aliyah, not permitted to do it. I never allowed him to do either one in that kind of situation. Because I felt that it was a deliberate act, and it was an act that undoubtedly could lead to a lot of problems. In one situation, in my shul in Kew Gardens, on the other hand, where already I had 95% of my membership Orthodox, so there's one fellow who was a member of the shul, and who's not Orthodox, but he's an old-time member. His father was a member of the shul, a German Jew, because mine was primarily a German Jewish community. So what happened there was, whenever he had Yortzeit, he wanted to daven. So Shabbos, he knew he couldn't daven. So that was never a question. But during the week, so my Balabatim were very upset with this. So I had to. So one day I said, "What do I do here?" They were very upset. So I came up I used the Gemara in Yevamos, you know, that for the sake of Shalom, you can twist the truth, just a little bit, whether it's mutter, whether it's mitzvah, you know, the two lashonos that apply. And I created a yahrzeit for myself on the day that he had a yahrzeit. and since he it's true. And since he and I both had a yahrzeit on the same day, so I divided it with him. What I did was the Pesukim de Zimra I let him daven, and the rest I davened. No, seriously, he accepted it with good grace. And I think to this very day he's convinced that I have the yahrzeit on the same day that he has. But that's the reality. You have to deal with that. You have to be innovative, you know. And I like to feel that I was whenever it was necessary from that point of view, without really, you know, hurting anybody in that sense. I tell you that's really a very, very important key. So I think that, it's late already. So I used to, there are many other things in this area that we could talk about. But the truth is that in the final analysis, the Rav has to have a number of very important elements working for him. Number one, he has to be knowledgeable in terms of the halacha and not be afraid to use that knowledge. On the contrary, without using it, then he's no longer a Rav. There were times, I'm not going to go into details now, I have to tell you, but my son knows this, where I stood up almost alone against the whole congregation. because the halacha said what the right thing, this was the right thing to do. There was never a time that I didn't win any battle that I fought, but it's because you have to fight correctly. But that's number one. You have to be certain in terms of the halacha. You have to know where you stand. You have to be ideologically correct, and at the same time, you've got to be warm, and you have to have a perspective that reaches out to everybody and makes everybody feel comfortable and warm and wanted. That's what it is. And I want to tell you that one of the real tragedies, I think, in today's world, and that's part of the problem that I think even my son alluded to, is that we don't have enough potential Bali tshuva in our shuls. There was a time before there was a Bali tshuva movement that rabbis were making Bali tshuva, and they were doing it as a matter of course, as a matter of their rabbinate. There are a whole slew of these people that I can look to, that I know that I made a difference in their lives and raised their level and created something new for them. And that's why I'm hoping that a goodly number of you will have this ambition and this goal and this mission to become part of what I think is the greatest calling in the world, which is the rabbinate. You want to summarize it?
Maybe just if there are any other questions, I guess. I don't think it's time for to go into the details. I mean, the faster rubble or the faster, I guess. So if there are questions, if there are no questions.
Good.
Okay.
Listen, I'll be back here. I'll be in this room in another hour's time.
Can you get the chocolate? Wait, can you give me the, can you make a little gist or something?
Yeah.